Okay, last time we saw how God, in the fullness of time, came and sent his servant Moses to go and rescue the Israelites from their period of bondage and slavery in Egypt and to take them to the promised land. We saw how God, with a mighty hand, showed his power both to Pharaoh, to get Pharaoh to let the Israelites go, but God could have had Pharaoh let the Israelites go in a much easier fashion. But the bigger thing is to reveal himself to the Israelites. The Israelites had spent 430 years in Egypt, and all they knew were the Egyptian gods. They knew Yahweh, but they had been under the control of Egypt for so many years, and there was Egyptian god stuff all around them, Egyptian culture. And these were not to be a group of Egyptian refugees. This was to be a group of God's people. And so God needed them to realize who he is and their relationship with him. And so he started out last time we saw in revealing his power to the Israelites. They knew this is God. This is Yahweh. This is the God. This is the creator of all. This is the God who's more powerful than all the powerful gods of Egypt. And the plagues that we looked at were all focused on showing that God is more powerful than the gods of Egypt. You know, for example, the god Ra, the sun god, when he made the plague of darkness, and the animal gods, and all the others. They all there are people who have gone back and shown how each one of the plagues targeted different gods of the Egyptians to show that Yahweh is more powerful than the Egyptian gods. So the Israelites got to see a little bit about who God is. What they also need to understand is what it means for them to be people of God and live in a relationship with God, what God expects of them, what it means to be God's people, not just the people following God, but God's people. And we'll see that now that it's just the Israelites, that they are no longer in a foreign land in Egypt. They're no longer under the control of foreign people, of other people. They are their people. They are God's people. And so God starts to reveal to them more and more about what this means. And their first time that they go off and they're headed to the promised land, and God immediately starts revealing himself more and more to them, starts revealing to them more and more what it means to be a people of God. And we'll see that today. If we look back in Deuteronomy, Chapter 29, we'll see the purpose that I just mentioned of why all the plague process, because God could have taken a much easier way to get the Israelites out. But in Deuteronomy 29, verses 2 to 3, it says, Moses summoned all the Israelites and said to them, "Your eyes have seen all that Yahweh did in Egypt to Pharaoh, to all his officials, and to all his land. With your own eyes you saw these great trials, those miraculous signs and great wonders." So the Israelites, who now needed to trust God more than anything because they were going to a place they'd never been. This has been hundreds of years. They don't know it yet, but they're going to be in the wilderness for quite a while. And they need to learn to trust in this God. And so God has revealed himself to them. They saw by their own eyes his power. Okay. Did they recognize God's almighty power and put their trust in him? The next verse. "But to this day, Yahweh has not given you a mind that understands, or eyes that see, or ears that hear." Okay? So they've seen things, but they aren't connecting the dots, because God hasn't put a spirit in them to connect those dots. And so they don't quite get what God's trying to teach them here. And this is in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is with the next generation. These are the people that when the Israelites came out, and we'll see in the next few weeks, that they didn't trust God. And so God said, "Okay, you're going to stay here in the wilderness for 40 years before I bring you into the promised land. And by that time, everyone, all men who are 20 years and older will be dead, other than Joshua and Caleb, the two spies that did trust God." This Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy, is Moses recounting and retelling the stories to this second generation, this generation that will go into the promised land. And so here Moses says, your eyes saw all this. In other words, you being Israel have seen this, but you didn't understand it. And all these years you still don't understand it because God hasn't made it all clear to you, even though it looks clear to us. So God had not helped them see, hear, or understand. So why did they need God's help to be able to see and understand and hear? 1 Corinthians chapter 2, starting at verse 7, and you could read all verses 1 through 16 to get more on this. But Paul says, we speak of God's secret wisdom, a wisdom that has been hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. However, as it's written, no eye has seen, nor ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love Him. But God has revealed it to us by His Spirit. The Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. So God had not put His Spirit in them so that they could understand these things, even though it was laid out before them. Now, as Moses is talking to the Israelites in Deuteronomy, he's reminding them of the events and experiences that they've had over the previous 40 years, and that they had a purpose. And what was that? What was that purpose? Back to Deuteronomy 29:5-6. He says, "During the 40 years that I led you through the desert, your clothes didn't wear out, nor did the sandals on your feet. You ate no bread and drank no wine or other fermented drink. I did this so that you may know that I am Yahweh, your God." Through those experiences, they knew that Yahweh is God. And that, not Yahweh is God, but Yahweh is their God, is your God. Okay? And as a result, you had to trust in me. Your clothes would have worn out in 40 years. You know, can clothes really last 40 years that you wear every day? People didn't have a big wardrobe. They had maybe a couple sets of clothes. But yet for 40 years, they never wore out. The shoes on their feet didn't wear out. They never had any crops, no bread, no wine, and yet they lived for 40 years. God provided for them. The only way they could have existed, they could have lasted this 40 years, is through God. And so they had to put their trust in Him, and that's what these experiences taught them, is to put their trust in the Lord. Okay, so we'll write that across your sheet here. So trust in the Lord. As an example, just when they first left Egypt and encountered the whole Red Sea experience there, did it have any effect on teaching the Israelites to trust in the Lord? Well, let's look back at the results of that in Exodus 14, verses 30 to 31. We looked at the story itself last time. It says, "That day Yahweh saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. When the Israelites saw the great power that Yahweh displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared Yahweh and put their trust in Him and in Moses, His servant." So as a result of seeing God's power in saving them from Pharaoh's army at the Red Sea and with the whole Red Sea crossing, they realized there's no way this could happen other than by God, and they put their trust in Him. So it did lead to that. How long did this faithful trust last? Well, let's go to the next chapter. Now you have at the beginning of chapter 15 through verse 21, you've got this song of praise for Moses and the people, and then also there's Miriam's song of praise, praising God for the Red Sea crossing. Then we get to verse 22, the very next story. Okay, "Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter." That's why the place was called Marah. Marah means bitter. "So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, 'What are we to drink?'" So immediately as they run into some kind of a crisis, some kind of a trouble, they turn on Moses. And they grumble and gripe and complain. And so even though they had this great Red Sea crossing experience that taught them to put their trust in God, they run out of water, and they no longer trust God. God's shown them that He's in control of things, that He's going to save them and protect them, but yet, when they have a need, they don't turn to Him. Instead, they complain to Moses. And, you know, you'll see this over and over again as we go through these stories. You kind of see it in your own life a little bit, don't you? When you have tough times, what is your first inclination to do? Is it to gripe and complain and grumble and, God, why are you letting this happen to me? Or is it to turn to God and to put your trust in Him and to pray to Him and to look to Him to get you through the situation? And that's what we have in all these experiences that the Israelites had during their 40-some-odd years in the wilderness. They met with a lot of crises and trials. And those crises and trials, God used those to teach them to put their trust in Him. So we can add the words crises and trials. Now the stories that we're going to look at, we're just looking at Exodus 15 through 33. So this is just in the first few months. We're not going to look today at all the multiples of years of the 40 years. And so you can just see in a short period of time, the number of crises and trials and the number of things that they encounter that God uses to teach them to put their trust in Him. So let's look at some of that. Well, we just looked at, the Red Sea crossing. You know, for instance, back in chapter 14, verses 10 to 12, we are reminded of the crises. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to Yahweh. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us in the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Let us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? You know, it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." So they have this problem. They have this crisis. The Egyptian army is bearing on them. They realize that they're dead people because there's no way on earth that they're going to get out of this. And they turn to Moses and say, "Things were so nice in Egypt. It was so much better. Why'd you bring us out here in the desert to die?" Okay, forgetting about the horrible conditions that they lived under of slavery. And you see God's response to that. There is no way on earth that they could get out of this. But there is a way under heaven. Okay, verse 13 and 14, Moses answered the people, "Don't be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance that Yahweh will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. Yahweh will fight for you. You're not going to have to fight. Okay, you need only to be still. Don't worry about this because you're right. You cannot get out of this, but God can get you through this and God can take care of this." And then verse 28, the water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen. The entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea, not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. How does that happen? There's no way on earth that that happens, but there is a way under heaven. So God taught them to put their trust in Him. And we saw in verse 31, when the Israelites saw the great power that Yahweh displayed, the people feared Yahweh and put their trust in Him and in Moses, His servant. So it had the effect that God intended, that crisis. But then we see in 15:22-24 that we just looked at, that they immediately have next time they have a crisis, they turn on Moses again. The people grumbled, verse 24, said, "What are we to drink?" How does God respond to that? Well, something that doesn't make any sense because there's no way, again, under earth this could happen, but there is a way under heaven. Moses cried out to Yahweh, and Yahweh showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. So you got this polluted water, this bad water that they can't drink. Moses takes a stick and throws it in, and the water becomes sweet. The water is drinkable then. There, Yahweh made a decree and a law for them, and there He tested them. Okay, so He tested them through this, and they failed the test. But nonetheless, God showed them, and He said, "If you listen carefully to the voice of Yahweh your God, and if you do what's right in His eyes, if you pay attention to His commands, and you keep all His decrees, then I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought on the Egyptians, for I am Yahweh who heals you." So He makes this promise, if you follow Me, if you trust Me, if you look to Me and obey Me, then I will lead you, I will take care of you, I will protect you, I will not let any of the bad stuff happen to you that I let happen to the Egyptians. And He proves that by making the water sweet. So they have this drinkable water. They had no water. They came across some bad water. They couldn't drink it, but just by throwing a stick in it, God made it better for them. And then the next verse on top of that, then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees, and they camped there near the water. So out in the desert, they come to this place with nice, an oasis, okay, with lots of streams, lots of water, lots to furnish this large group of people, of a few million people. So God again shows that he's in control of the situation and teaches them to put their trust in him. Okay? So, they obviously have learned to put their trust in him. So, let's go on. Next verses. Chapter 16, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. So, we're just talking 2.5 months here so far from when they left. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by Yahweh's hand in Egypt. You know, if those plagues would have killed us too. There, we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. It was a smorgasbord. It was so great in Egypt," they're saying. Okay? "But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly with death." Was it God's plan to take them out in the desert and kill them? Let them die to death from no food? No, he's already shown them that. Red Sea, well, just by showing his mighty hand in the plagues, they know that he's God. But yet, look how fast they turn. So they have this crisis of no food, and they have not yet learned to trust God. So God makes a way that they have to trust him, to teach them to trust him. Going on, we'll jump to verse 11. Yahweh said to Moses, "I've heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight, you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know I am Yahweh your God." Now, what God says here is kind of impossible. They're out in the desert. There are no quail in the desert. There is no bread in the desert. There's no grain. There's no... Where are they going to get this stuff? It's physically impossible. Well, going on. That evening, quail came and covered the camp. In the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is it?" For they didn't know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It's the bread that Yahweh has given you to eat." So, out of nowhere come all these quail. They want meat? They got meat. Okay, later on in another verse it says, they get so much quail it just comes out of their nostrils. They're sick of it. Okay? But they want meat, they got it. God gives it to them. And then in the morning, they've got this "what is it" stuff out there. Okay, you know what the Hebrew word for "what is it"? Manna. That's what the word manna means, is "what is it?" That's all it is, all it means. Okay, something that we've never seen, we don't know what it is. You know, it's something that God did for them. And What's interesting is how he took care of them through that. If you go through, they're supposed to gather. If you go through the rest of that chapter, you see that every morning there's manna out there, and they're supposed to go out and they collect what they need. Okay, if it turns out someone doesn't collect enough, it just turns out to be enough. If it turns out that someone collected too much, well, you're not supposed to do that. You can't keep it to the next day. Some people, and Moses told them not to. Some people tried to keep it to the next day. They got up the next morning out of bed and they looked, and it was just full of maggots. And stunk real bad. So it was very clear that they couldn't keep it till the next day. So what did that mean? Every day they had to trust God that God would provide this, what is it? That God would provide this manna for them to eat every morning. So they went to bed trusting God that when they got up in the morning, there would be food for them on his table. Now, what's also interesting, what else he does, because you say, okay, well, it's just some natural weird thing that was happening out in the desert. Okay, well, on the seventh day, every week, there was no manna. 6 days, every morning, there was manna. The seventh day, there wasn't. And on the sixth day, because of that, the sixth day, they were instructed to gather twice as much as what they needed. And then they would save it for overnight, but because the next day was a Sabbath day, because it was a seventh day and there was going to be no manna, it was fine. It was not maggot-filled and putrefied and, it didn't go bad on them, but only on that night. So every week they saw that this was not just some weird natural occurrence, that this was God doing this. Okay, and they saw it every day, they saw it every week. And they did that for over 40 years. They saw that. Okay, going on. Well, that was chapter 16, gives you that whole bit of the manna. What's going on? Chapter 17. Okay, I'll just start in verse 1. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as Yahweh commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Sounds familiar, right? So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses said, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put Yahweh to the test?" You know, he's teaching you to trust him. When you have a crisis, turn to him. Turn to him in prayer. Trust him. But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children live and livestock die of thirst?" So they're always blaming Moses, always complaining to him, not looking to God, and blaming him for taking them from the great lush life in Egypt. Okay? How does God respond to this? Verse 5, Yahweh answered Moses, "Walk ahead of the people. Have them follow you. Take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. And so water came from a rock. Something that's impossible to happen, but God made water come from a rock. So again, the Israelites meet a crisis, and God responds with a lesson teaching them to put their trust in Him. One other example we'll look at, just the next story, next verses. Verse 8, the Amalekites, a group of Amalek descendants, came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim, while they were there at Rephidim, drinking water out of a rock. Moses said to Joshua, so the next crisis is they're attacked by this group of people called the Amalekites. Okay, what happens? Verse 10, so Joshua fought the Amalekites. Joshua, this is the first time we see him. He ends up being the successor to Moses. Remember, Moses is over 80 years old at this time. Okay, and he's still got 40 years ahead of him, but he's already old when his task starts here. So Joshua fought as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady until sunset. Okay, all day. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with a sword. So this is a group of men. It's a big army, a big group of people, right? 2 million people, 600,000 men. How well trained are they for the military? They're not. They're about as far away from being trained for the military as you can get. The Egyptians did not want them to know how to be a military, how to fight, because these are slaves that could turn on them. Okay? And yet they defeat this attacking army of Amalekites. Now, they see this thing that when Moses has his hands up, they're winning. When Moses has his hands down, they're losing. What does having your hands up or down have anything to do with anything? Nothing, other than showing that it's purely as a result of God's interaction and intervention that Israel defeats the Amalekites. So you see these various crises that the Israelites run into, and through those crises, God intervenes, God reacts, and gives them a lesson in teaching them to put their trust in Him. Did God's intervention always achieve the desired results? Now look at Numbers 14, verse 11. Yahweh said to Moses, "How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe me in spite of all the miraculous signs I've performed among them?" Okay, you see God a little frustrated with their stubbornness and reluctance to trust Him. And, you know, "I've shown them all these signs. I've intervened all these different ways, but they still do not put their trust in me." Okay, in spite of the miracles. Right? But yet God loved them and God continued to intervene. And why did God continue to intervene? Again, back to the verse that we've read twice already. When the Israelites saw the great power that Yahweh displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared Yahweh and put their trust in Him and in Moses, His servant. So then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord, I will sing to Yahweh, for He's highly exalted. He's my strength and my song. He's become my salvation. He's my God. I will praise Him, my Father's God, and I will exalt Him. That's the purpose. That is God's intention when He intervened in a crisis, is to teach them that He was God, He was their God, He was Yahweh. They were to put their trust in Him, and He would take care of them. Okay? When we have crises, do we turn to God? Do we put our trust in Him? Do we recognize that He is God, He is our God, He is Yahweh? Now, one of the things we started looking at in chapter 16 is a way that God reminded the Israelites every day to trust in Him. Okay, again, Exodus 16, starting at verse 17. And this is what I was telling you before. The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much. This is the manna. Some gathered little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, no one is to keep any of it until morning. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. God provided manna every day. They had nothing to eat until they got up in the morning, and God had provided this manna. But they had to collect it, and then it went away. It didn't just stay there. It melted away during the day. But it was nutritious, and it fed them. Why were they instructed to gather a double supply on the sixth day? Verse 23. He said to them, this is what Yahweh commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So, bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning. So they saved it until morning as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. Eat it today, Moses said, because today is a Sabbath to Yahweh. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they couldn't find any. So we have God providing them this bread to sustain their life every day, and that teaches them that their life depends on God, that they need to trust in Him. And that teaches them to trust in Him, a daily reminder and a weekly reminder of that. Now, God gave us a miraculous sign for our crises and trials. If we look at John 6, verses 30 to 35, they asked Jesus, what miraculous sign then will you give us that we may see it and believe you? What will you do? You know, our forefathers ate the manna in the desert. As it's written, He gave them bread from heaven to eat. That was their miraculous sign. Well, Jesus said to them, I tell you the truth, it was not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it's my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is He who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. Well, sir, they said, from now on, give us that bread. Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty. Okay? So Jesus is the true bread from heaven, our bread of life, the bread of eternal life, the true bread of heaven. Okay? He was our miraculous sign through which we trust God. Okay, so we have crises and trials that where God intervened and taught the Israelites to put their trust in Him. Okay? The next thing that was critical for this new nation, right now it's just a big group of a lot of people, of slaves. There's no organization. Okay, they got Moses at the head, but that's it. And we see this early on turn into the need for organization to help them be God's people here. Exodus 18, you can read verses 1 through 16. We'll just start at verse 13. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning until evening. When his father-in-law saw what Moses was doing for the people, he said, What is this you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge? While all these people stand around you from morning till evening. Just big lines of people wanting to come talk to Moses. Moses answered him, because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws. That's the kind of leadership they had, is they only had Moses. If anyone needed a leader to decide something, they had to go to Moses. Well, for a few million people, that's a lot of work for that one person. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, saw that. And verse 17, Moses' father-in-law replied, what you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. There's too many people. You're going to wear yourselves out. So instead, this is what you should do. And he goes on. He says, listen now to me and I'll give you some advice. And may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties that they're to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times. But have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this and God so commands, you'll be able to stand the strain and all these people will go home satisfied. Okay? So Jethro saw what needed to happen. And Jethro, again, was the high priest of Midian. And we've already talked about that. That would have been, he was a priest of Yahweh. Midianites also being descendants of Abraham. And he saw, you need to set up an organization here. And he laid this out for him. And you are still the leader. And you still have a lot to do. And you need to teach them what it means to be God's people. But all this day-to-day smaller stuff, you need other people who can handle that for you. And so then we see a bunch of organizational setups. If you look at the book of Numbers, okay, the name of that book is just kind of what the topic starts out with. In the first few chapters, we deal with a bunch of numbers. If you look at chapter 1, you see they take a census. It starts out with appointing some of these leaders and identifying leaders of each of the tribes. Okay, you've got that listed, and then you've got censuses that are taken of each of the tribes to find out how many people there are. So you got to know if you're going to organize a group of people, you got to know how many people there are and how they're divided up so that you can set up the organizations properly. And so that's what you have in the first chapter of chapter 1 of Numbers. Chapter 2, you then get some organizational, okay, this group is going to be moving around. Well, how do you get a couple million people to move around? How do they know when to go? How do they know when to stop? How do they know where to stop? How do they keep from trying to stop in the same place and having some arguments? I want to stop here. No, I want to stop here. Okay? So chapter 2 talks about all that and gives some organization to the systematic encampment and breaking of camp by the tribes. Okay? And then Numbers 3 and 4 talk about some of the... there's one tribe that wasn't counted in the census in chapter 1, and that's the Levites, because they were to be the people who... they were to be the priests and to help the priests. And so they had some specific other duties that they had to do on a day-to-day basis, religious duties, and those are discussed in chapters 3 and 4, and that talks about what their responsibilities are. Okay? So you've got all this organizational structure. You also have back in Numbers 10, you can look at that on your own, but Numbers 10 talks about a communication system, okay? How do you know when it's time to go? How do you know when, if Moses needs to talk to all the leaders, or if Moses needs to talk to the whole assembly or whatever, how do you know that? And they set up this trumpet. You know, whenever you hear so many blasts of the trumpet, then so-and-so comes, that kind of thing. And so that's put there. So organization, by having this organized group of people, they can then be organized to be God's people and learn to trust in Him as a people. Okay? The next thing with this new nation, this new group of people, the only laws that they know are the laws of Egypt. They've been there for 400 and some years, but it's not Egyptian laws that they're called to have. They're called to be God's people, and so God then lays out laws for them that fit their people. Okay? Let's kind of pick up in chapter 19 with our story. We've gone through 18 so far. Chapter 19, we see, starting in verse 1, in the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. So it's only been 3 months. And they come to this Mount Sinai. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of that mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and Yahweh called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel." So they came to Mount Sinai 3 months to the day after they left. A quarter of a year. Is there anything interesting about that? How did Moses know that God was going to speak to him there on Mount Sinai? Well, if you remember back in chapter 3, Mount Sinai is where Moses saw the burning bush and where God came to him and gave him the calling to go and take the people out of Egypt. And in verse 12, God said, "I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this very mountain." And sure enough, 3 months after they leave, they show up and they come to that mountain. Okay? And God speaks to him, and God has a message for the Israelites. We saw there in verse 3. Okay? It says, "This is what you're to say to the people of Israel." And what was that message? He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." These are the words you're to tell to the Israelites. So that's the message. Obey me. Keep my commandments. Be my people. Put your trust in me, and you will be my people. Actually, everybody's my people, but you'll be my special people. You'll be a kingdom of priests. You'll be a holy nation. You'll be the people through whom I reveal myself to the rest of the world. You'll be the people through whom I send the Savior for the whole world. Okay? You'll be my special people if you be my special people, if you trust in me, if you obey me, if you look to me. Okay? So that's the basis of his message here. How does Israel respond to that? Well, so Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words that Yahweh had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together and said, "We will do everything that Yahweh has said." So Moses brought their answer back to Yahweh. So you see their responses. Of course, we want to be God's people. We want to be God's special people. We will do whatever He tells us to do. Okay? We will obey Him. We will keep His covenant. And then we see in the next chapters, and really on into the book of Leviticus and some in Numbers as well, what it is that means. What does it mean to obey God? What does it mean to keep His covenant? Okay, and God lays out what we call the law. Now there's three different types of law that you'll find here in the Old Testament, that you'll find that God lays out here. One type you'll see in chapters 21 through 23 of Exodus. Just as a brief example, you could kind of pick almost any of them here, but in 21 verse 33, if a man uncovers a pit or digs one and fails to cover it, and let's say an ox or a donkey falls into it, well, the owner of that pit must pay for the loss. He must pay the owner, and the dead animal will be his. So if you dig a hole and somebody's cow comes by and falls into that hole and dies, and you hadn't covered that hole up to protect, well, then you got to pay for that cow, okay? And then you got to worry about disposing of that cow. So, in other words, what kind of law is this? These are the civil laws. How the laws that deal with us getting along with each other, with us living in a group of people, in a society. These are the political laws of the Jews. Can political laws change? Can civil laws change? Yes, of course. They change every day. We've got a government, we've got a Congress that exists to do nothing but change the laws all the time. Okay? And the law evolves with time. The civil law does. So the civil laws that we have in here, you know, how many of you have dug pits that a cow could fall in? You know, those, we've got our own laws here in America dealing with those issues. But God lays out some initial civil laws to get this new nation started. And their laws evolved over time as well. But we see examples of those there. Another type of law that we see, the book of Leviticus is pretty well dedicated to this, but you see it in Exodus, and you see it in a few other places too. If we just look at, for example, Leviticus chapter 23, will give us an example, say verses 26 to 27, and again, there's a zillion examples here you can pick up. Yahweh said to Moses, "The tenth day of the seventh month is the Day of Atonement." Okay? Yom Kippur. "Hold a sacred assembly and deny yourselves and present an offering made to Yahweh by fire." And it goes on. And that's just an example. That's a festival, one of the feasts that they're to hold, to a special day that they're to celebrate. Okay? Do those change over time? Yeah. Do we celebrate Yom Kippur? Most of you probably don't even know when Yom Kippur is, unless you've got a Jewish friend. But we celebrate Christmas. We celebrate Easter. We celebrate the great things that God's done in our life. We may not celebrate Passover anymore, but we celebrate the Passover meal. We celebrate the fellowship meal, the meal that of the new Passover Paschal Lamb that sacrifices when we celebrate the Lord's Supper. So we do have these festivals and feasts. It talks about sacrifices. Do we sacrifice in our offerings that we give? Do we give of ourselves, of our time, of our talents, of our treasures? Okay. So ceremonial law, that's the second type of law, that can change over time. It has to do with how we interact with God. Okay? Now God's still God and God never changes, but we change, and so how we interact with God can change over time. Okay, churches will have traditional worship services, more liturgical kind of services with old hymns, or they can have contemporary services with music that was just written this year and more rock oriented, that kind of things. Which one is right, which one is wrong? Neither. They both are different ways of expressing praise and worship to God. And so you can see that changes over time. The third type of law that you find, Exodus 20, is kind of a key example. We'll just read the first few verses. God spoke all these words, "I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Number one, you shall have no other gods before me." And then he goes on. What is this? This is the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments is a good example of the third type of law, moral law. Okay, moral law. Setting the standards, setting what God's standards are. Ten Commandments are just one example of that. Now, will moral law change over time? Today's culture will tell you that it does. Today's culture will say, what goes for you doesn't necessarily go for me. Everything's relative. Nothing's absolute. But God makes it very clear in His book that there is absolute. That it's not relative, and what's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong, and there is no gray there. Moral law never changes. God never changes, and what God accepts as being right, what God accepts as being wrong, that doesn't change. Okay, He's even written that into our hearts. So the moral law never changes, where the civil and ceremonial laws can change. Now the Ten Commandments, you see them in a couple of places. You see them here in Exodus 20. You also see them recounted again in at the beginning of Deuteronomy, when Moses is restating and reminding the next generation of Israelites before they go into the Promised Land of everything that's happened to them. And at the beginning of his story in chapter 5, he states and restates the Ten Commandments that we find in chapter 20. Okay? Those Ten Commandments, the first one, you find in verses 3 through 6, "You shall have no other gods before me," okay, "and shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven or above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So that's the first one. The second one, verse 7, you shall not misuse the name of Yahweh your God, for Yahweh will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Then number 3, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath, a rest to Yahweh your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor an alien within your gates. For in 6 days Yahweh made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore Yahweh blessed the seventh day and made it holy. Okay, so those are the first three. Now number 4, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land that Yahweh your God is giving you. Number 5, you shall not murder. Number 6, you shall not commit adultery. Number 7, you shall not steal. Number 8, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Number 9, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. Number 10, you shall not cover anything that belongs to your neighbor, or you shall not, is really the bottom line of it, but you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or his maidservant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Okay? So there he lays it out. Now you may find some different denominations or groups may pick them differently. For instance, the Catholics, instead of you shall not cover your neighbor's house, they say your neighbor's wife. And 10, they keep the same. Other Protestants may split out number 1 and combine some other ones, you know, split out and say, you shall have no other gods before me is the first one, and you shall not make for yourselves an idol is the second one. But we put those two together as the first one. Now, what are all these? And some good meanings behind them. And we could spend a lot of time just going into these and discussing them. But let's get really to the bottom line of really what all these mean. You know, like you can get into them. And the Jews in Jesus' time, the Pharisees, who were dedicated towards making sure that that people obeyed God, that people didn't accidentally break a commandment. So they took the commandments, they took God's law, and they wrote laws around them and expanded on them. Let's make sure that no one breaks this, so let's make a law that's even further out there so that even if they break that law, they may still keep what God's law really is. And they got into all sorts of nuances and details. And this say the one about remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. They had volumes of what it meant to work on the Sabbath day and what it meant to keep that holy. So, you know, do we need to worry about that? You know, we've had blue laws in America where businesses couldn't be open on Sundays, okay, because that's keeping the Sabbath day holy. Do we need to go to that? What's the deal? Well, rather than trying to get deeper into the details, Jesus took a different approach. And he said, now, let's just look at what the commandments are all about. Let's just look at what God's law is all about. You can summarize it this way. And in fact, there's two tablets of the Ten Commandments. The first three, as you see, deal with our relationship with God. Okay? Have no other gods before me. Do not take my name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. The other ones all have to do with our relationship with other people. That's called the second tablet. The first tablet, Jesus summarizes in Matthew 22, and he does so by quoting Deuteronomy 6:5. Matthew 22, verses 37, Jesus replied, "The first and greatest commandment in the law is, love Yahweh your God with all your heart and your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment." Okay? And that summarizes it. If you love the Lord your God, if you love Yahweh with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, then you're not going to have other gods before Him. You're not going to take His name in vain. You're not going to have trouble remembering His Sabbath day. Okay? And then what about the other tablet? Verse 39, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets are That's what they called the Old Testament back then. All the Old Testament hang on these two commandments. All the scriptures hang on those two commandments. So the second one, if you love your neighbor as yourself, are you going to kill him? Are you going to steal from him? Are you going to lie to him? Are you going to commit adultery against him? No. Okay, if you love your neighbor as yourself, all those commandments are taken care of. And so that should be your focus, is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, and then all those commandments will be taken care of. So how else would you summarize all that? Well, Paul summarizes them in Romans 13, starting at verse 8. He says, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another, for he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law. The commandments, do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not covet, and whatever other commandment there may be, they're all summed up in this one word, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to its neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. So, again, if you focus on love, loving the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and loving your neighbor as yourself, then all the commandments are taken care of. And to what level do we need to take care of that? What does God expect of us? How well does God want us to keep his commandments? Jesus answers that in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, verse 48. He says, be perfect, therefore, just as your heavenly Father is perfect. That's the standard. No sin, no breaking any commands. Being perfect, just as God is perfect. Okay? James also talks about it. James 2, verses 10 to 11. He says, for whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at just one point is guilty of breaking it all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. Well, if you don't commit adultery, but you do commit murder, you've become a lawbreaker. Okay? So, we were not called to do our best at keeping the law. We're not called to keep half of the laws. We're called to be perfect, just as our Heavenly Father is perfect. Okay? Well, and Paul talks a lot about this in Romans. You know, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You know, how then can anyone... can we keep God's commandments just as he wants us to keep them? Is it possible? If we look at what John has to say in 1 John chapter 1, verse 8, if we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. Okay, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. None are righteous, no, not one. We have Paul quoting in Romans. So then, if we're not righteous, if we cannot keep the law, if we're all sinful, and if we've broken the law once and we cannot be saved by the law, then how can anyone be saved by the law? Galatians 3, verse 11. Clearly, no one is justified before God by the law, because the righteous will live by faith. We cannot be justified by the law in the sight of God, because all of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We've all broken some of the law, which means we've therefore broken enough of the law to keep us from receiving eternal life as a result. But Paul says there, we're declared righteous by our faith. We see that in Romans 10, verse 4. You know, where can we find salvation from sin? It says, Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. So we are declared righteous through our faith, not because of obeying the law, not because of being better than so-and-so or doing the best that we can. That will not save us. Instead, we're saved by our faith, by being declared righteous in God's sight because of our faith in Jesus Christ. So, if the law can't save us, if obeying the law was not going to get us to heaven, well then why bother? What's the purpose of the law anyway? Then why did God even give us the law? Well, Luther gives us three good reasons for that. And we see these in various verses, for example. The first is a curb. A curb, if you drive down the road, you've got the curbs on the sides of the road. As long as you stay within those curbs, you're fine. If you go past that curb, you may find yourself in the ditch. You may find yourself hitting a telephone pole or a street light. Okay, you're going to have problems. But if you stay within the curb, everything's fine. So it shows us the limits where God wants us to live. It stops outbursts of sin, helps keep order in the world, all of that. 1 Timothy 1, verses 8 to 9. We know that the law is good if one uses it properly. We also know that the law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels. And going on, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy and irreligious, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for adulterers and perverts, for slave traders and liars and perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to the sound doctrine that conforms to the glorious gospel of the blessed God which he entrusted to me. So the law is there showing us the curb. It's not there for those who are just naturally going to drive down the middle and never come close to the curb. It's not there for the righteous. It's there for the lawbreakers. It's there for those who go past the curb so that they know that the curb is there and they won't go past the curb. Okay? It's also a mirror. Okay? Paul talks about this in Romans 7, verse 7. He says, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Indeed, I wouldn't have known what sin was except for through the law. You know, I wouldn't have known what coveting really was if the law had not said, do not covet. So it's a mirror. It shows us our sin. It shows us what sin is, and it shows us that there is sin in our lives. It's easy to see sin in someone else's life. It's easy to see someone else sinning. Is it easy to see ourselves sin, or we always want to give it an excuse? Oh, well, this so-and-so, the devil made me do it, Flip Wilson said. Or, you know, there's always some excuse or some reason. But no, it's sin. And the law shows us our sin. It shows us that we are unable to be perfect. Shows us that we do need Jesus Christ. That we do need his salvation. Okay? And then the other thing that it is it's a rule. It teaches us how to live a God-pleasing life, a life that will be blessing to us. Psalm 119, this is in your reflection questions for the week at the bottom of page 4, your response questions. One of those, number 4, has got you reading this whole chapter. It's the longest chapter in the Bible, but one note on this, it's all about God's law. It's all comments on the law of God. And you'll see it's in sections, and each section in the original Hebrew, all the verses in that section began with that letter. And it's in alphabetical order in Hebrew, starting with Aleph, then Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, etc. So each in that section starts in the Hebrew language with that. So we don't see that in English, but it's kind of a memory approach, and we've seen some English books, especially kids' books, that are like that. But just a couple verses out of here. For example, verse 1, blessed are they whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. So as we live according to the law, as we live according to the rule that God's given us, we'll be blessed. Blessed are they whose ways are blameless. And then verse 9, how can a young man keep his way pure? Well, by living according to his word. Okay, so we live according to God's word, according to God's rule, to be pure and be clean. Okay? So, the law is given to us. Law and legislation are there to help the Israelites and us know what it means to be people of God and be able to put our trust in him. So how well did they do this? After while Moses was receiving this law on Mount Sinai, how faithful were the Israelites during that time? Exodus chapter 32, we'll zoom ahead past some of the chapters of some of the laws and commands that God gave. And so Moses is up on the mountain still receiving these laws that we see here. Chapter 32, when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, Aaron, hey, come make us gods who will go before us. You know, as for this fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. You know, he's been up there a while. We don't know what's going on. We don't know where he is. And then verse 4, let me just go on. Aaron answered them, well, take off your gold earrings and that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. So all the people took off their earrings, brought them to Aaron. He took them, what they had handed him, and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." Now contrast that with Exodus 20, verse 2, that says, at the beginning of the Ten Commandments, "I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of your land of slavery." So here, Aaron, who is the high priest, Moses' brother, the kind of the second in command at this time, makes an idol, makes a golden calf. You know, why a calf? Well, that's what they're used to in Egypt. They've seen those. That's the gods that the Egyptians kind of worshiped. So he made this golden calf and said, "Okay, here you go. Here's your God that you can look at." Now, the Ten Commandments, the moral law that we looked at, what tablet had they just broken? The first tablet, dealing with their relationship with God. Okay, love the Lord your God. And they've created this idol. Well, when Moses comes back, how does he react? Verse 19, "When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned and he threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf they had made and burned it in the fire, and he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it." And then you also see in verses 25 to 29 that you get the story where Moses then has the Levites go around and kill with a sword those who had opposed Yahweh, who had stood against and supported this idol. And 3,000, it says in verse 28, about 3,000 of the people were killed that day. Is that an appropriate reaction? Well, yeah, they're to be God's people. They're to have no other gods. They're receiving the law right now, and they've already been destroying the law before the law was even fully given to them. So we need to love God in order to truly love our neighbor. And so Moses was rightfully upset and reacted here. What's interesting is to see what Aaron explained what had happened here. Okay, Moses said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that you led them into such a great sin?" "Oh, don't be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him.'" Okay, so that's so far so good. Then he goes on. He says, "So I told him, 'Whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off.' And they gave me the gold. I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf." Come on, Aaron, you've got to come up with something better than that. He threw the gold in the fire, and this calf just happened to come out. Okay, right. We've seen Moses' response. What was God's initial response to this idolatry? Now, God knew what was going on, and God even told Moses about it when he was up on the mountain before he came down and saw it for himself. Verses 9 to 10, God says, "I've seen these people, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now, leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation." Okay? So he says, "I'm tired of these people. I'm ready to kill them. Let me get rid of them. Stand back. I'm going to get rid of them. And then I'll turn you into a great nation, and you'll be my nation." Well, is that part of God's plan? No. But God takes this opportunity to not only express his displeasure with these people and their lack of trusting in him and faithfulness to him, but he uses it to test Moses. "Okay, Moses, is this about you or is this about me and my people?" And he places this in front of Moses. And then how does Moses respond to that? Does he pass his test? In verse 11, Moses said, "Yahweh, why should your anger burn against your people who you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth? Please turn from your fierce anger. Relent and do not bring disaster on your people." Verse 14, "Then Yahweh relented and did not bring on his people the disaster that he had threatened." So Moses passed the test. He recognized that this is about Israel. This is about God's people. This is about God fulfilling his plans for these people. It's not about me. God has called me to lead these people, but God's plan does not revolve around me. And he passed that test. We go on, and later on we see that Moses tries to offer himself as an atonement. Atonement has to do with at-one-ment, being at one with God. They have separated themselves from God in this building of this calf and worshiping of this golden calf. And need to be brought back at one, as one, with God. How does Moses try to offer himself as atonement here? Verse 30. The next day Moses said to the people, "You have committed a great sin, but now I will go up to Yahweh. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses went back to Yahweh and said, "Oh, what a great sin these people have committed. They've made for themselves gods of gold, but now please forgive their sin. But if not, then blot me out of the book that you've written." Okay, kind of a risky and awful thing to say here, but Moses says, "Forgive them, or else blot me out of your book. Okay, take me out of your existence forever." I don't know what Moses is trying to do here, but he's pushing a little hard here, I think. But he tries to offer himself as atonement. How does God respond to that? And what does God say that especially turns the Israelites to repentance? Well, you can read verses from verse 30 on through chapter 33, verse 6. We'll just kind of get to the end of it here. God says, "Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you're a stiff-necked people and I might just destroy you on the way." When the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments. Okay? So when they realized that God may not go with us, you know, we can't live without God. He gives us food every day. He protects us. Look what he did with the Amalekites. Look how he's taken care of us in crises. Look at the organization he's given us, the laws he's given us now. We need him. And so they realize their need for him. So this helps build their trust in Yahweh, their trust in the Lord. Okay? Moses intervenes, and how does God respond when Moses asks God to stay with Israel? Verses 15 to 17. And Moses said to him, "If your presence doesn't go with us, well then don't send us up from here. How will anyone know that you're pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth?" So then Yahweh said to Moses, "I will do the very thing that you've asked because I am pleased with you and I know you by name." Okay? So for Moses' sake, he would go with the people. All right? One other thing that we see that God did to teach his people to trust in him is implemented rigid discipline. And some of the things that we find here just seem a little kind of over the top. Well, just take a look, for example, and this is just one example of many, at the golden calf incident. Chapter 32, verse 20, we see that here when Moses came down, he took the calf they made, burned it in the fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. So they had to drink this golden powder. So that was a punishment. Then you see in verses 26 to 28, Moses stands at the entrance of the camp and says, "Whoever's for Yahweh, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him, as well as other people. Then he said to him, "This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side, go back and forth through the camp, from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day 3,000 of the people died. So here you see this rigid discipline of killing of 3,000 people being executed. As a result, and then verse 35, and Yahweh struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf that Aaron made. Okay, so then there's a plague that goes through the camp, and people get sick, you know, maybe because they drank that gold powder. I don't know, but the point is, you've got this rigid discipline for these people to be God's chosen people. They are to show the rest of the world what it means to be God's people, what it means to live in a relationship with God, and to live under God's laws, God's perfect laws that can be a blessing as you live under them. Well, as you go beyond them, there's consequences. And so God uses rigid discipline to keep them within the curbs here. Okay? Some examples. You've got the Exodus 32 verses we just looked at, the sin being the idolatry or the golden calf incident, and then God's discipline being executions and plague. Leviticus 10, you've got this real short little thing. It says Aaron had four sons, and the first two, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers, these are things that you burn incense in, put fire in them and added incense, and they offered unauthorized fire before Yahweh, contrary to his command. Okay, so we don't know what that means really, but whatever it was not in agreement with what God commanded on how they were to offer incense or whatever. Sounds like they were doing something on their own rather than giving praise to God. And as a result, verse 2, fire came out of the presence of Yahweh and consumed them, and they died before Yahweh. So they were burned in God's fire. Sounds pretty rigid as far as discipline, right? Chapter 24, we see another example here. Chapter 24, verse 11. Verse 10. Now the son of an Israelite mother and an Egyptian father went out among the Israelites, and a fight broke out in the camp between him and an Israelite. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name, that is Yahweh, with a curse. They brought him to Moses. Okay? So he cursed God in this fight. Okay? And other people heard it. So, doesn't sound like a big deal, right? But, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Second commandment is right there. So what happens as a result? Verse 13, then Yahweh said to Moses, take the blasphemer outside the camp. All those who heard him are to lay their hands on his head, and the entire assembly is to stone him. As you blaspheme God, take his name in vain, or curse God, the penalty for that is death by stoning. They tried to do that with Jesus. Jesus was accused of blasphemy. Stephen, he was killed by being stoned for what he was being accused for, blasphemy. Okay, Numbers 12. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. Apparently, Zipporah, his first wife, had died, and he had taken another wife here. Has Yahweh spoken only through Moses? They asked. Hadn't he also spoken through us? And Yahweh heard this. So they were jealous. There's a jealousy here. Of Moses. They go, who does he think he is? God speaks to us too. And then as a result of that, verses 9 to 10, the anger of Yahweh burned against them, and he left them. When the cloud lifted from above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous like snow. Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy. So God inflicted Miriam with leprosy as rigid discipline for her jealousy. Okay. And then chapter 16 is just another example. The whole chapter, interesting story called Korah's Rebellion. But a guy named Korah and some other people came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said, you've gone too far. The whole community is holy. Every one of them. And Yahweh is with them. Why then do you set yourself above the Lord's assembly? Jealousy, but disrespect for authority. This is going beyond the Miriam thing, to where, who do you think you are? God has placed Moses in charge of these people, but they're questioning that. Okay, and what happens to them as a result? In fact, let me back up a few verses because it's kind of interesting. Moses says in verse 28, "Well, this is how you'll know that Yahweh has sent me to do all these things, and it was not my idea. If these men die a natural death and experience only what usually happens to men, well, then Yahweh has not sent me. But let's say Yahweh brings about something totally new. Let's say the earth opens up its mouth and swallows them with everything that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the grave. Well, then you will know that these men have treated Yahweh with contempt." As soon as he finished saying this, the ground under them split apart. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed them with their households and all Korah's men and all their possessions. They went down alive into the grave with everything they owned. The earth closed over them, and they perished and were gone from the community. So you see God's response to that and God's discipline. So they're questioning Moses' authority. He had them swallowed up by the earth. Again, this appears very rigid, and it is, but it was setting the standard for this group of people who were to be the model, the example, the people through whom God was going to reveal the rest of the world, himself to the rest of the world. All of this, the crises and trials, the law, the organization, the rigid discipline, all of that God put into place, and the Israelites experienced all that in their journeys, in their wilderness travels, to teach them to put their trust in God. those things happen in our lives so that we can learn to trust in God as well. Let's pray. God, our Father, we thank you for the lessons that you give us, the stories of other people and how they interacted with you and how you responded to them in teaching them to put their trust in you. We thank you that we see stories of how you continue to forgive them, though they were stiff-necked and stubborn people and continued to reject you, but yet you continue to pour your love to them and forgive them and bring them back to you and work on teaching them to put their trust in you. We're thankful that we see those stories because we realize in that you have exceptional patience with us as well, and that in your grace you offer to bring us back to you, although we reject you and we're stubborn and we're stiff-hearted as well. Forgive us for that. Teach us, continue to send your Spirit in our lives to teach us to put our trust in you. We thank and praise you that we can do that in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.